I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
MSW Media.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Beans for Thursday, October 29th, 2020. Today, Ratcliffe ad-libbed his line about the Iran hack hurting Trump. The Trump campaign leaves hundreds stranded in the freezing cold after his Omaha rally. Kushner is on tape with Woodward saying Trump overruled science in favor of reopening the country, and 200,000 have died since then. The White House says it has ended the pandemic. Congratulations. The FBI Agents Association urges Trump and Biden to keep Ray on as FBI director. The New York Times anonymous op-ed and subsequent book author is revealed, and 20 former Republican U.S. attorneys endorse Joe Biden. I'm your host, AG.
And I'm Dana Goldberg.
Hey, what's good? See, I did it.
Well done. I want to tell you, so I actually have good stuff. I could tell it, you know, during our good news segment, but I want to start the listener off with something positive. So you know that I had a virtual gala, I had a virtual Biden-Harris event last night. Mm-hmm. And on Facebook, I know some people aren't on Facebook for good reasons, but I hosted a virtual event with 30 iconic female, like, artists. Was like Gloria Steinem and Tammy Baldwin and, you know, Billie Jean King. And I hosted and we raised $215,000 for the Biden Victory Fund last night.
Oh, yep. My gosh. That's awesome. Congratulations.
Yeah.
That is incredible.
Good stuff.
And, you know, virtual COVID safety high five. For that, our Beans listeners, we've been doing this for a while using a special link that was given to us by the Biden campaign. We've raised just a little over 200,000 for
nice.
Joe and Kamala over the last couple of weeks. So
nice.
You and me, kid.
I know. I mean, because I'm not like performing live now, like the way I'm making any sort of money is from, honestly, a fan, you know, my fans listening from tips, like a tip jar and Venmo and PayPal and stuff. So when I did the interview with Mary Trump live on Facebook, I basically told the audience I'm going to, you know, donate a large portion of the tips this time to raise this. And so I got to donate $100 to each of six senatorial races that are super close in Montana, in North Carolina, Georgia. So that felt good too. So I've done my good deeds for the week and, you know, my bills are paid this month. So I thought I would pay it forward and people showed up, which was really nice.
Oh, awesome. Congrats. Yeah. And, I have a bill coming due on, November 4th. I promised.
Oh God.
This was sometime last year. I tweeted at Tulsi Gabbard and I said, Tulsi, I will donate $1,000 to the charity of your choice if you stay the fuck out of the presidential race as a third party candidate. And I don't know if it was because of me or because nobody would vote for her, but a promise is a promise.
I'm going to go with both. At least you're honoring your debts. I like it. I like it.
So I need recommendations for a charity. Because I told Tulsi it would be the charity of her choice. She hasn't gotten back to me. Super weird. If you have any recommendations for that, you can send them in along with good news, confessions, and all that other stuff.
Yes.
At dailybeanspod.com and click contact. Our happy hour is tomorrow, 4 p.m. Pacific time. We aren't opening it to the public again because we got it crashed the last time we did that. So that's for patrons. And also for patrons, we've got a new book club starting this Saturday. I'm doing this one by myself. It's the Andrew Weissman book, Where Law Ends Inside the Mueller Investigation. And we will be hosting a live election results show on, obviously, election night. It starts, I believe, at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific. It is myself and Kelly from Two Broads Talking Politics and Jennifer from Electorate. And we've got some incredible guests lined up, including Frank Figluzzi, Andy McCabe and his family. So the McBabes will be there. I know you want to see that. Just a whole bunch of great guests, Barb McQuaid, and you need to be there, David Rothkopf. It's going to be cool. So we will see you then. Today I'm going to be talking to David Enrich about the latest New York Times tax story that he helped write, and a Democratic candidate of California's 42nd district, Liam O'Mara. So that should be cool. Real quick, in the Al Capone's vault story of the day, the anonymous op-ed writer is Miles Taylor. Dun, 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 wah, nobody cares. And yeah. The FBI Agent Association has asked Trump and Biden to keep Ray on as director. They like him, apparently, the FBI Agents Association. So those are a couple of little brief headlines there, but we have some big ones to get to. So let's do it. Let's hit the hot notes. Hot notes. Okay, so lead story today, and no one's talking about this on the news right now because there's so many other ridiculous headlines happening throughout the country. Oh my God, to me, yeah. this is the lead story. DNI Ratcliffe ad-libbed part of that press conference last week. And I know this seems like 10 years ago, but this was last week that the Director of National Intelligence, Ratcliffe, who's totally, wholly unqualified liar with zero intelligence experience, came out in a press conference with Krebs and Ray standing right behind him, you know, Chris Ray, and said that Iran had hacked voter registration databases, which was true, and that there was an email that had gone out threatening voters, and he inferred that email scam, that, you know, it sent intimidating messages to voters saying, vote for Trump or we will come and find you, and it would list the voter's address and their name and their phone number. And Ratcliffe then sort of said in passing that that was designed to hurt Trump.
It's hard not to laugh.
I know. And we all racked our brains trying to figure out how sending a message to Democrats, by the way, and threatening them with revenge, physical bodily harm if they didn't vote for Trump, was designed to hurt Donald Trump. And we talked about that and how that it sounded off the cuff and wondered why Ray would stand there like that, like he was all cool with it, this obvious lie. Here's a quick clip from last Friday's Daily Beans about that. Let's listen. Also, why I think Ratcliffe said that the Iranian hack of the Proud Boys email that got sent to certain voters that said vote for Trump or else, he insinuated that that was to hurt Trump, which makes no fucking sense. But there you have now a pretext for Trump to say they were trying to hurt me, Iran, so he doesn't have to blame Russia. Iran tried to hurt me because I got rid of the stupid nuclear Iran deal that stupid Obama made. And so they interfered in the elections. Look, and then Russia will put out all this disinformation, sowing discord after the election, after voting, the polls close. And that is how they will try to contest this election. So I thought it was bullshit, and I decided it was probably a pretext for Trump to contest the election. I went on to talk about how so was the, you know, the jamming through and the ramming through of Amy Coney Barrett. Yes, she's going to repeal everything civil rights related, but also they got her in. I said they're going to get her in before the election. She's going to decide some of these election cases, especially if it's close. That's why we have to vote in numbers too big to manipulate. Well, anyway, back to Ratfuck. Out in Politico today, from the intrepid Natasha Bertrand, our hero, Ratcliffe did indeed go off script when he alleged during a press conference last week that Iran was sending intimidating emails to Americans in order to damage President Trump. This is according to two senior administration officials with knowledge of this, of the episode. The reference to Trump was not in Ratcliffe's prepared remarks about foreign election interference. And as shown to and signed off by FBI Director Chris Wray and senior DHS official Chris Krebs, the director of the department's cybersecurity and infrastructure agency. So his prepared remarks didn't have it. Chris Wray and Krebs signed off on his prepared remarks. And apparently Krebs and Wray were both surprised by Ratcliffe's political aside, which had not appeared in the prepared text. This is according to the officials. Yeah, but I'm betting pissed is more like it. And it was right around that time we learned that Trump was thinking of firing Chris Wray, too. Interesting. Ratcliffe attributed the emails to Iran, but said they were, quote, designed to intimidate voters, incite social unrest, and damage President Trump. This raised immediate questions about how threatening Democrats to vote for Trump could be aimed at damaging the president's reelection bid, of course, and how the intelligence community had made that determination within 24 hours of the emails going out. And this is also huge news, but it was kind of a buried lead here. Ratcliffe also, well, he decided on his own earlier that day to hold the press conference about the spoofed emails. And they were changing his, like, he was working on his remarks up until the last minute. But another area where he went off script, according to officials, he omitted any references to the Proud Boys by name during last week's briefing, even though the group was named in his prepared remarks.
Interesting.
Yeah. A senior intelligence official said that Ratcliffe's remarks were being edited, quote, until mere moments before he went on stage.
On stage?
On stage?
On stage. It's a whole show to them. That's all this is. It's a performance, AG. It's a performance.
Ladies and gentlemen, coming up next, you've seen him lie during his confirmation hearing. You may have heard him perjure himself for 18 U.S. Code Section 1001. Please welcome the one and only... the stage.
It's like a slips. It's a slide of the hand magic trick. He's so good at them.
Oh, good Lord. So anyway, these are a bunch of lying assholes. Yeah. And I hope, I can't wait till Ratcliffe goes down.
Speaking of assholes, the next thing is the White House. Speaking of assholes.
Speaking of assholes, nice segue,
the White House has claimed that they have ended COVID. So in my opinion, this is basically Donald's mission accomplished, George W. Bush moment. Mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished. Mission accomplished.
Yes.
Frick, frick, frick.
The White House included ending the coronavirus pandemic on a list of Trump administration's science and technology accomplishments. You heard that right. Accomplishments, despite nearly half a million Americans tested positive for COVID-19 in the past week, Allison.
Wait, there's a list of Trump administration's science and technology accomplishments? There's a list?
Actually, I think it's just very short. I think it might be just ending the COVID pandemic. Oh, wait, I bet
it's just the one line.
Yeah, I bet the Space Force has got to be on there. Space Force has to be on there.
Space Force, water on the moon, vaccines.
Yeah, I actually do want to check out this list now just for comedic reference. So a White House office. There's a White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Who knew? They released a claim announcing a document highlighting the administration's science and technology achievements over the past 4 years. So some of these highlights include ending COVID-19 pandemic.
Made bread. I love to see those lists, Dana. You're right.
Oh, my God. Could you imagine? Looked at Eclipse. Without glasses. Highlights include ending the COVID-19.
Highlights. We hosted an eclipse. It was the best eclipse.
Oh my goodness.
No one's ever seen. And I looked right at it. I can tell you.
Yeah. Got rid of technology when we got rid of the wind. It's very expensive. It kills birds. What the fuck?
We cured wind milk
cancer. I can't
believe
there's so much being said, like shit like that, that we've completely glossed over the fact that the president said wind was too expensive and it kills all the birds.
It causes cancer. That's what they did. They cured windmill cancer. That's on this list.
That's got to be on the list. Yeah. So was this a news release? This was a news release sent to reporters that read, and I quote, "From the outset of the COVID-19 pandemic, the administration has taken decisive actions to engage scientists and health professionals in academia, industry, and the government to understand, treat, and defeat the disease." Well, this is going to come up in a little bit, which is very hard when Kushner actually said the quite opposite. Anyway, we'll get there in a second. Now, this is despite us seeing record numbers across the country and the highest average of new cases per day since the pandemic began. The U.S. has reported a record daily average of about 73,000 new cases over the past week. This is an increase of about 40% from the average 2 weeks earlier and a 46% spike in hospitalizations. You know, I heard today in Utah, they might have to figure out how to ration healthcare if it keeps up in Utah and decide who gets the ventilators and who doesn't. Like, this is crazy, craziness in the news. So Kushner, like I was saying a second ago, even though they're touting that they listen to the scientists and blah, 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 Kushner actually boasted in April, mid-April, about how the president had cut out the doctors and scientists advising him on the unfolding coronavirus pandemic, comments that came as more than 40,000 Americans had already died from the virus, which was at this point ravaging New York City.
Feeling cute. Might cut out doctors later, IDK.
Oh my God. Yeah, this was actually back in April, Allison. This is that taped interview with Woodward. This is part of it. Mm-hmm. So Kushner told Bob Woodward that Trump was, and I quote, "getting the country back from the doctors," because you know how doctors like to hijack the country, "getting the country back from the doctors," and what he called a negotiated settlement. What the hell does that even mean? Kushner also proclaimed that the U.S. was moving swiftly through the panic phase and pain phase of the pandemic, and that the country was at the beginning of the comeback phase. This is in April. Over 180,000 more people have died since that statement. This is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. I need to stop saying crazy because I know it's out of context and it's not really applicable. This is ridiculous. That does not mean, and this is a quote, "that doesn't mean that there's not still a lot of pain and there won't be pain for a while," but that basically was, "we've now put out rules to get back to work," Kushner said. "Trump's now back in charge. It's not the doctors." Oh, that's terrifying. So humble, this was in brag, April. Right? Yep. This was in April that Trump had taken the country back from the doctors. The statement reflected a political strategy. Now, instead of following health experts' advice, Trump and Kushner were focused on what would help the president on election day. So by their calculations, Trump would be the open up president. Which just, God, the visual alone just made me want to throw up in my mouth a little bit.
Goatsy, right?
Ugh. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is exactly what we've been saying with the whole, you know, Maddow's been saying, watch what they do, not what they say. I've been saying that they've been just on the herd immunity train since the beginning, even though they've tried to keep that quiet. That's what they want. They want this virus to rip through the country so we can go really quickly through the death pain and the pain phase and the whatever, you know, to the open up phase. And then he'll be able to be elected.
It's like Kushner's five stages of COVID. Like, you know, there's five stages of grief. Apparently, these are the five stages of COVID. Right. The pain phase, the open up phase, the they've all lost their minds phase.
The open up president phase. Ugh. Yeah, it's sad and scary, and hundreds of thousands have died because of it. And this is kind of what we knew all along. We have to absolutely vote in numbers too big to manipulate. We have to get them out of there so we can put doctors back in charge of hijacking the country.
Yeah, and just a side note, if for some reason you're planning on mailing in your ballot, please do not do that. If you had not mailed in your ballot, I want you to walk it down to an official ballot box or take it into the city at one of their official voting locations. Do not mail it anymore. If you're listening to this, please just walk it in and hand it to them. It may not get there in time. And the post office, DeJoy, is just basically saying that nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the mail needs to get there on time. So that's what's up.
Well, thanks, DeJoy. I can hear him now. Hey, nowhere in the Constitution does it say that you have to get that stuff there on time. Like, oh my God, shut up. Next up, in the most obvious metaphor in the history of metaphors, last night at Trump's Omaha rally, he left hundreds, if not thousands, of people stranded in the cold. This I started following this story last night, I guess at probably about 9 Pacific time, which was close to midnight on the East Coast. And there was an Omaha underscore scanner account that was listening to the Omaha police scanner and putting out this update of tweets about what was going on after the rally. So when the rally started, there were a bunch of people waiting to get in, and he did the rally, and then he hopped on his plane and took off. And because of all the airport road shutdowns and closures because of the president, you know, thinking he's way more important than he is, in Omaha, right? Basically, the buses either couldn't get back to or didn't get back to pick up all of the people who didn't get in the rally or who went to the rally and needed a ride back 4 miles to their car. It was about 28 degrees Fahrenheit when this all started to go down. And people couldn't walk back. Many of these folks were in their 70s, and they could not walk back from the rally to their cars, which were parked, I guess, across and down the road up near the air, you know, closer to the airport, because he shuttled them there just fine.
Right.
But they couldn't get back. And so they were abandoned. They were stranded. And most people are like, oh, thoughts and prayers. But, you know, so a lot of these people were getting hypothermia. They were having seizures. Their mental acuity had disappeared. A lot of signs of hypothermia. I think 7 ended up going to the hospital. It was very serious. And, you know, I kept trying to reach out to people saying, is there anybody who can go pick these folks up? Anybody help us out? People are like, why should we help them? And I'm like, you know, call it the Hippocratic Oath if you want. Call it like when we're in combat, like on enemy soil, and we come across a wounded enemy soldier who's trying to kill us. We administer first aid. Even, you know, I've done this at the VA for years. There's a lot of like racist assholes that come in to get healthcare there, but we don't triage them based on their assholishness. You know, we just, are they sick? We help them and then send them on their way. But this was, to me, this was just really sad because he used these people, he bussed them in, used them as props, got money from them to buy swag, used them as props to cheer him on, and then just left him in the cold, literally, to freeze to death.
It is absolutely part and partial to this entire administration. I mean, it's a great example. It's a metaphor for this in the last 4 years.
Yeah, definitely.
What's positive news, though, AG, we've got 20 former Republican U.S. attorneys who endorse Joe. Yes, 20 U.S. attorneys who were appointed and served under Republican presidents as far back as Dwight Eisenhower announced on Tuesday their endorsement of Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. They said, we firmly believe that Vice President Joe Biden is the candidate who can and will provide the leadership we need to refocus the Justice Department on the cause of impartial justice and to address the deep-seated societal issues that are roiling our country today. The former U.S. attorney said in a statement, we give him our strongest endorsement, and we hereby announce that we will each be voting for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to serve as the next president and vice president of the United States, which is huge. This is huge. And it's just so nice to hear people saying that we want an impartial Department of Justice again. We don't want these to be the president's personal lawyers, which is what we've seen with Bill Barr. So the former law enforcement officials also voiced their concerns that President Donald Trump's leadership poses a threat to the rule of law. Yeah, I think we've all been saying that for about 4 years now. But these are people obviously very directly involved in this sort of thing. So they said, as the chief federal law enforcement officials in our districts, we were expected to work closely with state and local officials of all political affiliations to build a unified law enforcement partnership to protect and promote justice in our communities. The statement says, as we watch the turbulent events unfolding in our country today, we are concerned that the president has departed from this traditional mandate in several troubling ways. It continues to say he has politicized the Department of Justice, dictated its priorities along political lines, and breaking down the barrier that prior administrations had maintained between political and prosecutorial decision-making, a barrier that has been fundamental to the maintaining confidence among the American people that their Justice Department is acting as a fair and impartial arbiter of prosecutorial discretion. That was a lot in the last sentence, but I got it out.
Yeah, those were a lot of words right there.
I got it out. I haven't even started drinking today. Perhaps I need to. Yes.
Fair and impartial arbiter of prosecutorial discretion.
Arbiter of prosecutorial discretion.
That's hard to say, dude.
Right? We do. I mean, we've got to get the Department of Justice back. And I keep reminding people that a vote for Joe and Kamala is also a vote against not just Trump, but Pompeo, DeVos, Bill Barr. They all go. It's like a 5-for-1. Like, let's get rid of them all.
Ratcliffe. Yep. 100%. And that's super important. And I think that's why it's important Joe brought up in the debate in the town hall when they were doing their, head-to-head town halls, when he said, because I think it was Stephanopoulos who asked Joe Biden, like, hey, we got all these obstruction of justice charges from the Mueller report. What are you going to do with that? He's like, I'm not going to do anything with that. That's up to the Justice Department. That's what the Justice Department does. They decide. I hire prosecutors and they determine who they're going to prosecute and not prosecute. It's not me. And that was time for the Justice Department to be the Justice Department. And, not the personal lawyers for the president. Just much like how we learned yesterday that they're not going to allow the Justice Department to represent Trump in the E. Jean Carroll case, which pleases me so much. So
me too. I was surprised. I'm not going to lie, but I'm very grateful.
Yeah. Same. And we have some updates on yesterday's Trump tax story. That's the one about his Deutsche Bank loan forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Student loans don't get forgiven, but Deutsche Bank loans to Trump get forgiven. And I've gotten some more details from the experts. I'll be speaking with the author of Dark Tower, Deutsche Bank, Donald Trump, and an Epic Trail of Destruction. His name is David Enrich. He's on the byline for that Trump tax story in the New York Times. And we're going to talk about what he knows. And you'll hear about how Mnuchin was involved, Steve, along with some gifts given to Trump from Deutsche Bank the day after he won the election. It's truly an incredible story. Stay with us.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Hey everybody, it's AG, and this episode of Daily Beans is brought to you by Field of Greens by Brickhouse Nutrition. The pandemic didn't just test our country's economic endurance and resolve. It exposed how important it is that we keep our immune systems up and stay healthy. And that's why I recommend you take the superfood powder Field of Greens by Brickhouse Nutrition and do it every day. While other health products boast about one vegetable, Field of Greens has 18 clinically researched essential fruits and vegetables, plus green tea, ginger, turmeric, and beets. This powerful combination not only can support heart health, it can support a healthy immune system and also keeps your metabolism up and blood pressure and digestion healthy. Field of Greens is loaded with antioxidants, pre and probiotics. Just one scoop in a glass of water, stir up, and you're done. So why settle for one vegetable when you can have the entire Field of Greens? Add Field of Greens to your daily routine and see why our powdered greens have earned over 2,000 five-star reviews. So go to fieldofgreens15.com and get 15% off your first order with the promo code BEANS at checkout. That's fieldofgreens1515.com. Available in two flavors, regular and wild berry. Both taste great. Fieldofgreens15.com, and don't forget promo code BEANS. All right, everybody, welcome back. It's time to flip it blue.
I'm blue.
And joining me today for the Flip It Blue segment is the Democratic candidate for Congress in California's 42nd District. He is running against incumbent Republican Ken Calvert, who has held the seat since 1993. Please welcome Liam O'Mara. Liam, welcome to Daily Beans.
Hey, happy to be here.
I'm so excited to talk to you because California's 42nd is such a cool district. It's so unique, and there's such a great mix of voters and constituents and families there. And I was hoping you could tell me a little bit about the characteristics of your district. Who lives there?
Yeah, so it's Southwest Riverside County in California. So it's just over the mountains from LA and Orange County. And historically, it's been seen more as a dumping ground for those counties. We have tons of the logistics jobs, transport, factory, the warehousing and whatnot for things being shipped in and out. And historically, the area was also quite poor. A lot of that still sticks around. The area, the Inland Empire as a whole, which is Riverside and San Bernardino County, less than a third of the population make a living wage. But in my district, or at least in the western half of my district, there's a ton of bedroom communities of people who have fled the higher house prices in LA and Orange County. and settled in there, but it's never really built up much economically beyond that, which means that as they move in and these new neighborhoods get built up, the price of housing shoots up, and it's a lot harder for the people who already lived out here. And the eastern half of the district is still overwhelmingly rural. It's tons like farmland and open fields.
Yeah, so a lot of folks get priced out, and with the wages the way that we are, and especially right now because of this huge economic downturn, because of Republicans' inept handling of the coronavirus, you know, it's just gotten so much worse. And let's talk about COVID, and let's talk about probably one of the number one issues that I think is on the mind of a lot of voters in California, and that's healthcare. You know, unfortunately, we tie healthcare to employment a lot in this country. And when folks lose their jobs, which many millions have in this pandemic, they lose their health care. And then, of course, we have this administration and Republicans like your opponent trying to gut and repeal the Affordable Care Act without having a plan for replacement. Can you talk to us a little bit about your plans for getting everyone timely access to quality health care?
Yeah, I mean, they don't really have a plan to replace it because there's no desire to replace it. The Republican plan is basically, if you have money, you'll get decent health care. And if you don't, you can die. That's fine. Mm-hmm. They don't seem ever to care about the issue. And never mind the fact that it's a lot cheaper for everyone if we cover everyone. Because when people don't have access to the insurance, they end up, you know, putting off problems, or they go into the emergency room and that jacks the prices up for everybody. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. For me, I'm for a single payer model. And the key issue there is just one of cost. And what people often misunderstand about this, and that there's tons of like ridiculous talking points about it, like universal healthcare is socialism. Like, it's not at all. I mean, the key issue for me is it actually would create an effective thriving market in providing and providers, because you'd be able to go anywhere. You wouldn't be stuck within a particular network. The key is the inefficient insurance industry in between. There are some things that private businesses will do better and some things that governments will do better. And you need always to just pay attention to where those efficiencies best are. If we're all in the same risk pool with the same insurer, then the costs go down for everyone, because someone else's pre-existing condition or this or that is not going to jack up everyone's costs the same. Because again, much larger pool of people. And there's just massive efficiencies when you're not actually trying to make a profit off of insurance. The existing Medicare system, which doesn't have that larger pool as it is already like 10 times as efficient just in its administration as any private health insurer is. Mm-hmm. So just using something like that to replace only the insurance model is important to me. And it's also important. And honestly, it's one of the pet peeves I have about the approach to this has been the use of the term Medicare, because we've had the system since the 60s. It's been watered down considerably by Republicans over time. It does have co-pays. You do have to pay for prescription drugs. There's all kinds of things that are wrong with the current Medicare system. So when we say Medicare for all, we don't mean using that system for everyone. So if you have good insurance from your place to employ, you're actually still going to get a better policy, because this is going to cover dental, vision, mental health, and literally everything without the same kind of desire to deny coverage, which is so common in private insurance because they have to make money. They're going to say, well, you know, that test is very expensive. We're not going to run it. Sorry.
Or we're going to run a bunch of unnecessary tests as private doctors so we can get paid for those and cost everyone else a bunch of money and that'll jack up premiums. Yeah, and I think people staying on healthcare here and moving to something else that's on your platform but has to do with this is that we have one of the best global single-payer healthcare systems in the world right here in the United States, and it's called the Department of Veterans Affairs. And a lot of people just kind of miss that whole, you know, we have an incredible health system. Now, the Republicans like our healthcare for civilians are trying to privatize this, trying to make it for profit so that private doctors and private industry and healthcare insurers and third party administrators can pocket a bunch of money at our expense that doesn't have anything to do with healthcare. And I know that you really are a huge proponent of expanding and funding the VA and not privatizing it and getting the benefits to the veterans that they deserve. Can you talk about how you differ from your opponent on caring for your veterans that are in, and I know you've got a lot in your district.
Yeah, the thing that bugs me the most about, I mean, what we let Republicans get away with on veteran stuff. I mean, my incumbent there takes vast amounts of money from the defense contractors and is voted for every use of force. So he's perfectly happy to throw people into harm's way, but then he'll vote against properly funding care for people. So, hey, we have a lot of homeless veterans. You want to do something about that? No. Mm-hmm. Hey, how about some good healthcare for our veterans to take care of, you know, PTSD, or how about, you know, help people reintegrate better into the, you know, civilian life? Nah, not interested. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that just drives me nuts. Mm-hmm. The sad thing about the Republican strategy of regulatory capture that they've been doing heavily since the 80s and started pioneering a little earlier than that, you know, just basically putting people in charge of departments that want to destroy them and deliberately underfunding government services so that they start to fall apart. So you can then say, look, government is the problem. We should abolish it and privatize it. They've deliberately underfunded the VA. They have forced it to perform with less resources than comparable private hospitals do, and yet it still does fairly well. Mm-hmm. And the sad thing about this is that, you know, the care used to be, you know, world class and still can be in a lot of VA hospitals, but they intentionally harm the system as a way to try and justify shutting it down, which is only going to harm veterans. I mean, I just know from my own experiences here in my family and whatnot, especially my grandfather was badly injured, and because he had insurance through the VA, because he was a Marine in the Korean War, he actually was able to get care that, you know, was that you could actually afford. I mean, the number of surgeries that he had to have on his back would have bankrupted the entire family.
Yeah,
and because he had care through the VA, it didn't. You know, he was able to keep doing it. So, you know, I want to fix that system. Mm. I want to stop pulling the money out of the system, because if you're going to ask people to put themselves in harm's way for the country, you have an obligation to care for them when they come back.
Yeah, 100%. And that is the mission of the VA. And they are pulling out the money and putting it into private, sending veterans to private health insurance, private doctors, which costs the taxpayers more money and is sub quality care and takes longer. The wait times are longer. It's totally unbelievable. And folks like your opponent are also trying to take $2.2 billion out of TRICARE to privatize that as well, to take all the families off of who are normally able to get care at military treatment facilities at no cost. Now would have to go to private doctors. There would be a third party administrator, and the costs would shoot right through the roof again to the taxpayers. So it's not a good system.
No, and it's always the scam with regulatory capture. The private provision is not actually cheaper. It's not a better deal for taxpayers. What they have to do is they have to undermine the departments so much and then hit you with a propaganda war to say government is the problem in order to justify shifting it. But the whole point is to enrich donors. That's literally all they care about. It's about shifting taxpayer money to the already rich. It's basically just hoovering money out of our wallets and throwing it to their donors. It has nothing to do with quality of services. You know, yeah. A wide range of areas. It's true even for charter schools. Mm. I mean, charter schools are essentially a scam just in terms of what they say that they're good for, because they don't actually get better results than mm-hmm. the public schools. And in many cases, they get worse results than well-funded public schools.
Yeah, and they do it with prisons, they do it with everything, and drug companies.
All just a matter of making money for donors. It's nothing to do with the actual services.
Yeah, 100%. Now, you said you've got some rural areas, and let's talk about the environment, the impact of climate change, which, I mean, first of all, you believe that it exists, which puts you already, you know, leaps and bounds ahead of your opponent. But this is not only is the climate, you know, we I mean, obviously for reasons we need to get on that and we need to get on it fast, but that also impacts the economy and infrastructure. So can you tie those two things together for me in your platform?
Well, sure. And it is definitely having an impact. If you go back 20 and 30 years and look at average temperatures in our area, they were about 20 degrees cooler in the summers than they are now. We used to have summers in the 80s and now it's always in triple digits. And it's like, clearly this is a problem and it is going to affect a whole bunch of things, including the agriculture in the area. The thing that bugs me about complaints about the spending that would be necessary and anything about this. I mean, for one thing, let's start with the whole wasted argument about denial, right? Somebody can argue, sure, maybe this is happening, but it's not man-made. It's just natural. Even if you believe that, and the evidence is solidly against that, even if you believe that, you should still want to do something about that rather than just saying like, hey, I don't know, why don't we all just die? Because that's basically the Republican platform. Why don't we just die? We could still do something about this. And that really gets into the economics of it. Things like a Green New Deal would not cost us money. They would literally make us money.
Yeah.
People forget that we went to the freaking moon without raising taxes. And it created the computer revolution and put all these phones in everyone's pockets. You know, we now have like effectively a supercomputer in our pocket because of the microprocessor revolution that all of that government spending put in motion. Mm-hmm. It was a massive stimulus to large tech sectors of our economy. And it put the United States on top in a lot of industries for a long time. We stopped that R&D. We've been pulling money out from both the public and private sectors, and overall spending in R&D has been plummeting in the U.S. Relative to a lot of other developed countries, which means we're losing our edges. Mm-hmm. It bugs me that you can have people like Trump, you know, trying to shift blame for a lot of things over to the China this and like, you know, talking about, the Chinese are cheating or whatever. No, they're investing. And China now leads the world in solar cell and battery technology. Those were both ours. Mm-hmm. Hell, we had solar cells in the 1970s. Jimmy Carter put some solar panels on the roof of the freaking White House. Mm-hmm. Reagan took them back off. We were investing in these things before. And we gave up our lead in so many of these different areas to other countries. And then we blame them when large parts of our own industrial base starts to deteriorate. And just, I mean, infrastructure too is a key one. I mean, U.S. infrastructure is rated a D and it's declining in a wide range of areas. Internet access throughout my district is honestly terrible. We have subpar water quality. We have terrible air quality, the worst air quality in the state. But, you know, the water quality is fairly low. Roads are deteriorating. And we're not investing in any of the solutions of the future either. Again, with what a Green New Deal does is it says, let's invest in Americans, in American jobs, in American businesses, and American workers. Let's put this country back to work by building the things that we need. You're going to produce tons of great jobs in the process, and it's going to have a massive ripple effect and push up our overall growth rates. Mm-hmm. I mean, our area, for one thing, we still have a lot of cheap land in the district. You know, there's still a lot of like open areas there, and we have a lot of sunshine, right? Solar power is now the cheapest form of power generation. It has finally passed natural gas. It is now cheaper to build a solar plant and cheaper to run a solar plant. So, you know, per gigawatt of electricity or whatever, you're going to like save a ton of money with solar. So why not build a bunch of solar plants out here? Mm-hmm. We could clearly do it. You'd put tons of people to work. We'd make tons of money in the process, but no, we shouldn't do that.
Well, yeah, special interest money. Yeah, special interest money, lobbyist money prevents people like the incumbent.
Free money, you know, I mean, the lobbyists are going to dump their cash in there. And it bugs me that you let the same people who are refusing the investment in these areas claim the high ground in terms of national defense. The Pentagon has for many years said that global warming is the greatest national security threat the United States faces. Mm-hmm. And yet we're doing nothing about it. You're basically letting them sell out the country and still claim to be patriots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the Pentagon is. They're moving bases. They're starting to do stuff. I mean, they've been doing it, addressing it for a long time. They know. Yeah.
Congress does not.
Mm-hmm. Well, they know. But their money speaks louder to them. Before I let you go, I want to touch really quickly. I've got about another minute or two on a couple of really important things that deal with corruption, because your opponent voted against a bill to regulate foreign involvement in elections. We know that the dynastic corruption that happens within the Republican Party, we've talked a little bit about it already with the special interest money and lobbying groups. But let's talk about just a minute about criminal justice and campaign finance. Those are the two last things I want to touch on. I've got about a minute left.
Oh, wow. That's fast. Yeah, 98% of Ken's money comes from corporations and the wealthy. I mean, that's all he cares about. And his voting record shows that that's all he cares about. And it's given him a horrifying voting record in terms of our basic interests. But the money talks, and it does make it harder to get any, you know, to push back against these things. And it does affect criminal justice as well, a significant issue that he's running on because of the amount of money you can make on the prison industrial complex. Mm-hmm. It's a massive cash cow for people. So I mean, the fact that the U.S. has one quarter of the entire planet's prison population is a scam. Mm-hmm. If we want this to be a free country, we need to start talking about how to fix that stuff. And money is at the root of it.
Yeah, 100%. And then, of course, if you make it to Congress, which I'm definitely going to work hard to make sure that you do, we need to take a look at the bill H.R. 1 that's been sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk now for a couple of years. And, you know, we have to, you know, all the stuff in it about voting rights, ending cash bail. You want to end cash bail, abolish three strikes, criminal justice reform. And also equal rights. And I think that it's really important that we talk about that, expanding the Violence Against Women Act and pass the Savannah Act. Can you, and then, of course, Native empowerment. Can you talk about that for a minute? Because I think it's very important.
About which?
Like, I know. I'm sorry. There's just so much in H.R. 1, you know, that and then additionally, there's so much in
there is
equal rights
that we need to do in terms of criminal justice anyway. Yeah, I do want to reform the sentencing laws. I actually want to. I mean, Ken ran an attack ad against me talking about how Liam wants to legalize drugs. I'm like, yeah, duh. I mean, because legalizing drugs would actually let us solve the problem. Right now, we complain about the cartels and the violence and whatnot in Mexico and whatnot, and it's all because of the prohibition. And because of that, we can't actually treat people. Addiction's a medical problem. Yep. Instead, we throw tons of people in jail, which makes tons of money for everybody, and all the just money, corrupt money flowing into different judges or whatever because of the stiff sentencing. And that makes tons of money for people. I want not only to make it a medical issue and not a criminal issue, I want to release the people currently in prison for nonviolent drug offenses here, so we can start to make the whole thing a bit less profitable. Maybe mm-hmm. less money can flow into our corrupt politics because of that, and we can actually get real justice for Americans.
And it's a voting rights issue too. They would rather have these folks not vote, and I can't imagine why.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the whole idea. Okay. You can make an argument that someone in jail shouldn't vote, although I'm with Bernie on that one. I don't think it should affect your civil rights at all.
Same.
But once you're out, period, that's it. You're still a citizen. You get to vote. And to say that someone who had a felony at 21 can't vote at 65 is just insane to me.
Yeah. Or even at 22. You're right. It's absolutely nuts. And it seems like we're in agreement on all of these things. And I know most of the listeners are too. So can you tell listeners where they can contribute either monetarily or by text bank or phone bank, or if they want to see the rest of your platform, which is really incredible, by the way, let everybody know where they can do that. Would you?
Yeah, the easiest thing to do is go to liamomara.org, so liamomara.org, and right at the very top of it, there are the volunteer and donate links, and you can just check off the kinds of things you might want to do, and you can pitch in from there. And I just want to push back against the sort of like learned helplessness we often have in the left. It does not matter how much you have to contribute, you can still do it. A $5 a month recurring donation is extremely important. If you get a few thousand people to throw in just $5 a month, the price of a Starbucks coffee, you can win almost any house race in this entire country. We can compete with the billionaires, but we have to step up a little bit.
Thank you so much for talking with me today. Democratic candidate for U.S. Congress, California's 42nd District, Liam O'Mara. Thank you so much. Hello, listeners. It's AG for the Daily Beans. We have a different kind of sponsor for this episode, The Jordan Harbinger Show, which is a podcast you should be listening to. And I know every day somebody tells you you have to listen to this podcast, and you nod and go, yep, sure, and then you put it on your list and never listen to it. But don't let that happen here, because Jordan's show, which Apple named one of its best of 2018, is aimed at making you a better informed, more critical thinker so you can get a sense of how the world actually works and come to your own conclusions about what's happening, even inside your own brain. Each episode is a conversation with a different fascinating guest, and when I say there's something for everyone here, I really mean that. In just first of all, Jordan talks to a hostage negotiator in one of these episodes from the FBI, who offers techniques on how to get people to like and trust you, which sounds useful and disturbing, but it's amazing. Another episode tells a story of a cinematographer who discovered a lost city in a jungle and made one of the most important archaeological finds of the century. I recommend our listeners check out Jordan's conversations with Oliver Stone about writing, directing, and surviving the movie game, and episode 381 with comedian Neil Brennan, who is a friend of mine. I've done shows with Neil, and that's called Comedy's Triple Threat. Jordan's always focused on pulling useful, practical insights out of his brilliant guests, and we're not talking about pop psych or wishy-washy self-help stuff. These episodes are loaded with bits of wisdom that you can use to legitimately change your mind and improve your life right away. If that's not worth checking out, I am not sure what is. But we really enjoy the show, and we think you will too, so search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Joining me today is the author of Dark Tower, Deutsche Bank, Donald Trump, and an Epic Trail of Destruction. He just worked on a piece for the New York Times in the ongoing series about Trump's taxes. Please welcome David Enrich. David, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really good today. Thank you for joining me, because this is when you say epic trail of destruction, you aren't kidding. Today's story is pretty epic. And I want to start by talking about, obviously, I think the crux of this story here is that Donald Trump had a bunch of heavy duty loans forgiven. And if we could start first with some of the private hedge fund firms that kind of, as you say, threw their arms up and just sort of forgave this debt.
Yeah, and there's just a starting point, and my personal bias has always been to focus on Deutsche Bank. And one of the things I learned in reporting and writing the story is that Deutsche Bank is endlessly fascinating, of course, but it's been a mistake by me and others, I think, to not focus more on what happened with these big hedge funds and private equity firms. So the Trump Tower Chicago saga involves a big loan from Deutsche Bank and a slightly smaller but still very big loan for $130 million from a consortium of private equity and firms and hedge funds, led by Fortress, which is a big New York company, but also involving Cerberus, which is a huge private equity firm, and at the time was a small, kind of unheard of startup hedge fund called Dune Capital. And
that sounds familiar to me.
Right. And to anyone who's been following the Trump years closely, Dune Capital is, we all know what that is. It's the hedge fund that was co-founded in 2005 by Steven Mnuchin, who is now obviously the Trump's Treasury Secretary. And a bunch of hedge fund firms and private equity firms made this $130 million loan in 2005. In 2008, Trump defaults on that loan, as well as a bigger one from Deutsche Bank. And the lenders under the loan agreements, which I've looked at, had the right to seize the collateral, which in this case was the skyscraper that by the time of the default was mostly built in downtown Chicago. It's a huge building, 92 stories and millions of square feet. And it is a nice building. And but instead of actually playing hardball with Trump, and Trump started this process by preemptively suing both Deutsche Bank and this Fortress group, and Trump's tactics worked. And Fortress and its partners were basically scared about the prospect of getting in a huge protracted legal brawl with Donald Trump because of his reputation for being someone who is just willing to drag things out in court for many, many years on end, and his kind of you know, I might get in trouble for using this word, but basically is shameless tactics and spreading misinformation, including in the legal system. And it just wasn't something that they had much appetite for. So instead of trying to fight this out in court and get or and seize the building, or at least get most of what they were owed, they settled for $48 million, which is obviously only a small fraction of the $130 million they had lent, but it's an even smaller fraction when you consider that with accrued interest and fees that were attached to this loan that Trump was supposed to pay, it was going to be closer to $320 million that Trump was on the hook for on this one loan. And so they settled for $48 million of that, which left, again, my math, I'm trying to do math in my head, which is never a good idea, but it was a break for Trump of about $270 million, which, you know, to anyone, including billionaires, is a tremendous amount of money that was gifted to Trump because a bunch of hedge funds and private equity firms who are investing money for pension funds and things like that, by the way, just didn't have the stomach for a fight.
Now, when you get a loan forgiven like that, isn't that supposed to be taxed as income?
It's supposed to be reported as taxable income. And, you know, for normal human beings and normal businesses, we pay taxes on our taxable income. I mean, I certainly do. And I imagine you do. And most, you know, most normal businesses do. And I think many big corporations find very creative ways using offshore entities and just very sophisticated strategies to manipulate the tax system to either, you know, to basically minimize their tax liability or avoid it altogether. And that's the game Trump played. And he, there's not a, any evidence that we've seen that he did anything illegal here. But as with everything with Trump and his finances, he played a very aggressive game where he was able to spread out this reportable income from the canceled debt over a period of many years, and was able to kind of parcel it out in a way that in every given year that he was going to be on the hook for some of the taxes on this, those that the income was subsumed by losses, often losses that were just only on paper, like accounting losses, essentially, that either minimized or completely negated his tax bill. So he, the bottom line is he avoided paying taxes on almost all of this income, which is extraordinary.
Yeah. And I mean, it helps when you've got businesses that eat up your, you know, your taxable income in losses going forward, like his golf courses, et cetera, and casinos, the stuff that he fails at, which just ends up happening to work to his advantage.
Well, it's a combination just to, I mean, maybe you don't want to go down this path, but it's a combination of his business. He has not been a good businessman, with the exception of The Apprentice, which was him playing this role that wasn't actually real, of a real estate developer. And but I mean, it's partly that he is not a very good businessman and his businesses have been losing tons of money. But it's also partly because he, like others, is very adept at exploiting the intricacies of the tax code to their advantage. And I mean, Trump has bragged about this in the past. He's bragged about it on the 2016 campaign trail, how good he was at it, and vowed that he would use his skills at avoiding taxes to reform the tax code to make it fairer for normal people, which, you know, it's just gotten worse. And so it's, I don't want to, you shouldn't make it sound like it's just like the, he wasn't paying taxes because he was losing money. He wasn't paying taxes in part because he was losing money, but also in part because he was playing this very aggressive game to wipe out his taxes.
Oh yeah. 100%. And I believe, did you say, I think his reason for suing to have these loans forgiven was, it was during a financial crisis, right?
That's right. And he accused Deutsche Bank. So Fortress and those guys lent $130 million. Deutsche Bank lent $640 million. And so when it came time to pay the loan back in November of 2008, there's about $330 million outstanding on the loan at that time. And Trump just decided not to pay. And he had been, and he went on the offensive. He filed a lawsuit against Deutsche Bank and others, accusing Deutsche Bank of helping cause the financial crisis. And the most, again, I used the word shameless earlier, and this really is shameless, accusing Deutsche Bank of engaging in predatory lending practices against him, Donald Trump. And and I hate to take Deutsche Bank's side, but all they were doing was trying to collect on a loan under the terms of the contract. And that's, you know, there are many unreasonable things Deutsche Bank has done and continues to do. That is not one of them.
Didn't he say it was an act of God or that the financial
crisis? Well, he claimed that the financial crisis was an act of God. And there's a wonderful story around that as well. And that his lawyers were looking for an escape hatch in this loan contract in the days before the loan was due. And one of them heard Alan Greenspan, the former Fed chairman, who was like on TV or the radio or something, and described the financial crisis as a credit tsunami. And the lawyers looked at each other and said, what's a tsunami? It's a natural disaster. It's an act of God. And so if the financial crisis is a tsunami, which is an act of God, maybe we can take advantage of the provision that's in basically all big contracts that says in an event of an act of God, it's called a force majeure, you have the right in this case to have more time to pay back your loan. The problem with this argument, and I can't believe we're rehashing this 12 years after the fact, but the problem with this argument is that Trump and his other people in this company have been publicly boasting at the very moment they were making this argument in court, they're publicly boasting that they had, you know, billions of dollars at their disposal ready to spend at a moment's notice. So the notion that Trump was kind of caught between this lie that he was either he was lying about his financial position or he was lying about the financial crisis being that devastating to him. So pick your poison.
Yeah. And now, of course, we also know from talking to you before that a lot of these Deutsche Bank loans were paid by Deutsche Bank.
Yeah, which is a complete head scratcher, obviously. And one of the things that I learned in the reporting for this, and it was kind of an embarrassing moment for me because I have obviously spent years obsessing over Deutsche Bank and Donald Trump, but I actually went through all of the loan documents that are available in Cook County, Illinois, which is where this skyscraper is. And I found this whole other set of loan documents that made it clear that Trump had actually borrowed even more from Deutsche Bank than what was previously known. And basically what happened is that Deutsche Bank and Trump were locked in litigation for a year or so. And at the end of that period, they reached a settlement over this Chicago loan that basically gave Trump another couple of years to repay what he still owed. And at the end of that period, Trump still owed the bank about $100 million that he just had not repaid. And so he went to a different, that the loan originally had come from the investment banking side of Deutsche Bank, and which was now completely done doing business with him, given the way he had treated them. But Trump, through an introduction by Jared Kushner, went to a different part of Deutsche Bank, the private wealth management division, which agreed to lend him exactly $99 million to repay the $99 million that he owed this different division of Deutsche Bank. And again, this just goes to show how 4 years into the Trump administration, there's still a lot of mystery around his finances. The public understanding of that situation had been up until today that what Trump had borrowed was $45 million. And in fact, there's another $54 million loan that I just discovered in these Cook County documents. And, you know, that's a big difference. $54 million is a lot of money. And so that's just been kind of sloshing around. And Trump, to this day, has not paid back what he still owes Deutsche Bank on the Chicago loan. So there's still $45 million outstanding, and which comes due in, you know, what could, if Trump gets reelected, it'll be right in the middle of his second term in office.
Yeah, that other division, was that the Rosemary Vrablic division?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, got it. The listeners will remember that. Now, after all that, in 2014, there was another $24 million loan.
Yeah, and that's on top of all this. So, and again, that had not been previously reported on or publicly known about, at least as far as I was concerned. And yeah, so in 2014, Trump went back to Deutsche Bank and said, and this is at the same time he's borrowing from them for the Doral Golf Resort in Florida, the old post office building in Washington. So he's at this point run up $330 million in debt from the bank just in the preceding couple of years. And he goes to Deutsche Bank and says, look, I'd like to take out another $24 million on the Chicago project. They say yes. And it, what happens next remains a little bit confusing to me, to be honest. What all I could can see in, through public documents is that the, so as part of that $24 million loan, Deutsche Bank took as collateral units in the Chicago building. And so normally when a loan is repaid, the collateral gets released. And sometimes there are delays, but generally it happens around the same time the that the loan is repaid, the collateral gets released. In this case, the collateral was released on this loan on November 9th, 2016, which, as I'm sure you know, and I'm sure most listeners will remember, was the day after Trump was elected president. And, you know, it's, I don't know what to make of that. Like, first of all, it's possible it's a coincidence. It is. But it's also possible it's not a coincidence. And the scenario in which it would not be a coincidence is that Deutsche Bank, at from the moment Trump won the election, kind of swung into action to try and distance itself from Trump and from anything even tangentially related to Trump. And it, you know, it its executives considered releasing Trump from some of his personal guarantees on loans. They dumped or sold a big loan that they had to this big state-owned Russian bank at the time. And they even told their employees not to even utter the word Trump in any external public communication. So the bank at this point was scrambling to distance itself from Trump. And it's possible that that this was part of it. And it, but again, to emphasize, I just don't know. And the answers I've been getting through my reporting are frankly not satisfying.
I'm sure you'll let us know when they are. And I it's also of note, I think, that a lot of this you know, major initial Deutsche Bank loan for the Chicago Tower if I am remembering correctly, that Justin Kennedy, the son of Justice Kennedy, had something to do with the remittance of those loans.
Yeah, Justin Kennedy was at Deutsche Bank for about 10 years from 1998 through, so I guess 11 years, through 2009. And he, for most of that time, was working in the commercial real estate division of the investment bank. And he was, from around 2000 through 2008 or 9, was the point person on the Trump relationship. He was one of the point people on the Trump relationship. And he had a strong personal relationship with Trump and some of his kids. And on the Chicago project, Kennedy was one of the leading advocates for it. I mean, he spent a bunch of time with Trump and Ivanka talking about this, and he was really one of the kind of cheerleaders for it, I think, internally. And, you know, obviously this did not go well for Deutsche Bank, and very soon after this went kind of belly up and the two sides started suing each other, Kennedy decided that at that point it was time for him to leave the bank. And so he resigned and started up working in his kind of own real estate business, where he maintained very close ties to the Trump family. And so one way to look at this in hindsight, I'm not sure Kennedy would agree with this, and this might not be fair, but one way to look at this is that Kennedy's allegiance in a lot of ways was more to the Trump family than it was to the bank. And I'm saying that out loud, and that maybe that's not fair. I don't know.
There's some other things I could say out loud about the Supreme Court, but
there are many things we all could say about the Supreme Court, I think.
Yeah. But, you know, we do not have the evidence on that yet. Just a series of really, really interesting coincidences.
Yep.
And I mean, if I remember correctly, I think the FBI raided the tax office or the alderman office in Chicago where his building is. And I know that there was something that was happening with that, but I think it might have been connected to something else. I can't remember.
Yeah, I think that's, and there have been obviously a bunch of raids on Deutsche Bank that, you know, we don't really know exactly what those are about, but I don't have any good reason to think it's Trump related. And as far as I know, I mean, there have been lots of disputes in Chicago over what taxes Trump owes there, and even over just whether or not to put his name on the building. I think, you know, Chicagoans were not very happy with the huge letters that were slapped up on the side of the building in 2014. Mm-hmm. But I'm not aware of any law enforcement activity or investigations involving Trump and that project, aside from the fact that right now the New York Attorney General has been investigating whether Trump paid and reported the taxes appropriately when his debts were forgiven surrounding these initial loans.
Because that would be a New York tax issue.
Yeah, well, it could be a federal tax issue. It could be a New York, and the Trump Organization is obviously based in New York. Yep. And so that would give the New York Attorney General jurisdiction over it.
Yeah. And I can't think of the friendliness of the U.S. attorney in Chicago off the top of my head. But I also don't know if the state attorneys general or state attorney general or district attorney in Chicago is doing anything. I haven't heard anything on that either. One last question before I let you go. I have to ask, do you know how many more New York Times Trump tax stories are coming out in the series?
I don't. Is the bottom line.
Because we were speculating, you know, my co-host and I, Dana Goldberg, we're comedians. And, you know, when we set up a comedy set, we start with a strong opener and we've got a hell of a closer at the end of our set. And we were wondering if they were saving the best is probably not the right word, but the biggest for last, if there's more coming out before the election. I was just wondering how, like, what's going on behind the scenes, like how they're thinking about release, because I know there's a whole series of these stories.
I think you might be like giving us a little too much credit, honestly. Like, there's or not even credit, but like, you're, I think you might be overthinking the sophistication of our planning. Like, there's certainly the priority was and remains to get as much information out as possible. And I think the Times tried very hard and succeeded at getting a huge amount of information out into the public domain before most people had voted. And it's certainly like in a situation like this, where there's an election looming, and especially with people voting early and things like that, we certainly, and the Times' goal is obviously to have people as informed as possible, you know, ahead of a major decision they're going to make. And I don't think we, like, it's possible there are big stories to come in the week or whatever before the election. But and we certainly would not be deliberately holding things back at this stage.
No, I think this is mostly about the immensity of the immense nature of this story couldn't have been put out all at once. There's just no way. So much of it would have gone under the radar, and a lot of it would have been missed. A lot of people talk about the the old October story that Mary Trump supplied the documents for, is 14,000 words or something. Just such a huge story, and so I totally understand the need to put this out in a series rather than all at once.
Yeah, well, I can tell you that there, and look, my role in this is confined for the most part to this Chicago story that just ran. So I don't want to speculate on what is still to come. What I can attest to is the fact that there is still an enormous amount of reporting being done on many different aspects of Trump's finances, including but definitely not limited to his taxes.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much. Everybody, you need to get the book Dark Tower. Thanks so much, David Enrich. I appreciate you speaking with me today.
It's my pleasure. Talk to you soon.
Hey, everybody, it's AG. Healthy snacks have a bad reputation because, let's be honest, most are pretty gross and they don't fill you up and they're empty calories and they don't satisfy your cravings. But this helping of Daily Beans is brought to you by Monk Pack. They have cracked the code when it comes to making snacks that taste amazing but have close to no sugar. Monk Pack Keto Nut and Seed Bars contain less than 1 gram of sugar, only 2 to 3 grams of net carbs, and they're only 150 calories. They're great for anyone following a keto lifestyle and the perfect snack for anyone who wants to eat better or cut back on sugar and carbs without sacrificing taste. I've been trying to eat better, but I get tripped up on snacking. I love snacks, so it's really bad for me. But since I've been having the Monk Pack Keto Nut and Seed Bars, it's really helped. They have a perfect balance of sweet and salty, and they have that crunch that you need sometimes, because it's made of whole nuts and seeds. But they still manage to be soft and chewy, and they come in delicious flavors like pecan, almond, sea salt dark chocolate, and peanut butter dark chocolate. My favorite right now is the sea salt dark chocolate. It's so delicious. You can't go wrong. They're packed with protein. They're filling. They're satisfying. They're perfect for a quick snack. You can take them on the go with you on a bike ride or a walk. And in addition to being keto-friendly, they're gluten-free, plant-based, and non-GMO. And they have no soy, trans fats, sugar, alcohols, or artificial colors. So you can enjoy them while you're working out or running errands, like I said. So try it for yourself and you'll see. We have a special deal for listeners. Get 20% off your first purchase of any Monk Pack product by visiting monkpack.com and entering our code DAILYBEANS at checkout. To get started, just go to monkpack.com. That's MUNKPACK.com. Select any product, then enter code DAILYBEANS at checkout and save 20% off your purchase. Monk Pack, good for you, good food you can count on, and we thank them for sponsoring the podcast. All right, welcome back. Time for the good news. Well, we'll float on good news. It's on the way. Ah, the good news. It's here, finally.
I know we kicked it off at the top of the show, and now we get to end it. We're like sandwiching this episode with good news.
Yeah, it's kind of like our compliment sandwich, right?
It is. It's good news at the beginning, a little bit of Michigas in the middle, and then we've got the good news at the end.
A little bit of Michigas. That's what the show should be called. A little bit of Michigas.
A little bit of Michigas. I might actually have to start, rename my podcast A Little Bit of Michigas.
It's really good. I think you should do it. I would listen to that. Why don't you kick us off? We've got some news from, I think this is a correction from Melissa.
All right. I'm going to kick it off, but I'm going to sing the first verse. I mean, the first line says, "You're simply the best. You're better than all the rest." All right. So this is from Melissa. Yeah. No pronouns. "You're simply the best, better than all the rest." There's a quick correction on the oft-repeated idea of statehood for Puerto Rico. It's not a blue territory at all. Interesting. It's roundly assumed that statehood for Puerto Rico will automatically lead to votes for Democrats by any history of PR would include how both Republicans and Democrats have failed to follow through on helping Puerto Rico at multiple points in the island's history. This assumption also ignores the many conservatives remaining on the island who have fiscal power. I was thinking about this. Yep. On Puerto Rico and statehood, since we understand the idea is that statehood would mean Puerto Rico gets representation in U.S. government, but ignores the fact that Puerto Rico is currently a colony. A referendum is held on statehood regularly, and the people of Puerto Rico have never overwhelmingly voted for statehood. You can view the data online for each vote and also how the question is changed to manipulate one response or another depending on who benefits, Republican or Democrat. This is something that many Puerto Ricans on the island and the mainland are tired of hearing, and I hope that this correction can spark someone's interest in researching Puerto Rico's demographics for themselves. I love this incredibly intelligent community that appreciates being informed as well as being right. Thank you for everything, and we'll meet again on the other side of November 3rd. That's all for me. Thank you especially for listening, reading. It's because I feel like you actually listen and learn from your community that I wrote in the first place. You really are the coolest beans to have ever been.
Awesome. Thank you, Alyssa. I'm definitely going to start looking into that. I'm going to see if I can get anybody to talk to me about it. And because this has been something that has been brought up with court expansion, expanding the SCOTUS, expanding the federal bench, and then, of course, granting statehood to D.C., which we know would definitely be Democratic. But then, yeah, everyone assumes Puerto Rico. Wow, we get two more Democrats. That is something that I definitely will look into. And I kind of have just been sort of going along with what everybody else says on that, which is generally not like me, but it just seems so, like you said, that's just sort of roundly assumed, like you said. And so I think I was just sort of going along on that train. So that's really, really interesting. Thank you for pointing that out to me. I'll definitely do some research on that because it could become a reality and that needs to start being looked at. So thank you very much. Next up from Laura, pronouns she and her. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge the Yugamba people as the traditional custodians of the land from which I write to you and pay respect to their elders, past and present, and emerging. Oh, nice. I live in Queensland, Australia, and my good news is that this weekend we have an election for our own state level, and I'm excited to exercise my right to vote to re-elect a strong-ass female leader, Anastasia Palaszczuk, pronounced Palaszczuk. Okay. totally off base there, Palaszczuk.
That was awesome, though, that there was a correction right after you were like, Palaszczuk.
Palaszczuk. Nope. Palaszczuk.
Nope. Yep.
That is the premier. She's the premier there. She has been a force during the pandemic, making big calls and being strong for our state. And as a result, we in QLD currently only have 5 active cases. She's an amazing land mermaid. Amazing land mermaid. And I couldn't support her more if her name was Biden. I want to be a land mermaid. Is there are there lessons? Does Palaszczuk give lessons for land mermaidedness? Blind as it may be, I am a hopeful gal. And after taking the win here, I'm looking forward to watching the strength of the Biden-Harris ticket win big, then take control of the country, you and your response to the virus. But yeah, the doctors are going to take back control, right? The people will come together to look for look after each other and look after themselves. Your pod serves as my morning ritual, coffee, knowledge, and laughs. I can't thank you enough for shining your light. Your friends across the Pacific believe in and support you. Silly big love from myself and the pod dog, Darcy. Look at Darcy!
I don't know how this picture was taken, but they're both adorable. Darcy and Laura are both adorable. Look how cute that is. There seems to be some sort of like a winter wonderland. I mean, obviously a backdrop, maybe a backdrop. Either way, this is a really beautiful picture.
It's very, very cool. Everyone, you'll see it in the newsletter this week when we put it out there. Laura, thank you very, very much. And that was a beautiful introduction. And thank you for telling me how to pronounce your premier's name. And I love this. So thank you for writing in.
Yes. Next up, we have someone anonymous, however pronouns are. Hey, you, that fella. I like this person already. Hey, everybody. It's been 6 months since my last confession. I like when they start like this. It's so father, son, holy shit. Okay. It's been 6 months since my since my last confession. I reached out to Behind the Beans Facebook group during the past few months as I lost my job. Twice with 2 separate companies this year. My goodness. My wife also lost her job. This is extra tough on us because we moved halfway around the world in 2019 and our support network is back in New Zealand. We've also been dealing with online harassment and death threats from a disgruntled store owner for leaving a 2-star review online. I may regale you all of the story another time, for the police have dealt with the situation. In the meantime, I'd like to thank Rory for good advice. Well, the good news is that last week I took on a new role with a really good small company. I've decided that a low-stress environment with a good employer is more beneficial to me than trying to play career catch-up in a big corporate companies, as I retrained in this career around my 40th year, and I'm still learning the finer aspects of my role. My wife has taken a substitute teaching for now. This does put her at risk, as the schools in this country are remaining open despite the rest of the country being a strict lockdown. So please send her good vibes as she looks after herself. So thank you everyone for your support, and thank you AG, DG, Amy, Mandy, Jordan. No pod pets, as I've attached a photo of my wife with a friend of ours. Bonus points if you can recognize her. That would be the Prime Minister of New Zealand, and I knew that before I saw the caption, because she's a badass.
She is such a badass. Absolutely love her, and she just won re-election, didn't she? In a landslide, I think.
By a massive number. A landslide.
A landslide.
Landslide.
I love it. Thank you. Thank you so much. Next up, from Adrienne from Phoenix. Pronouns she and her. Oh, that's my mom's name. My confession is a weird kink I have. God. This is not my mom. I feel like it may be the music, the voice, the accent, and the substance, but Michael Cohen's podcast makes me want to play with a toy while I listen to it. Is that horrible? He's been turning me on lately. Although I know it will be very short-lived, I've been taking advantage of the moment. Sorry, but I can't go 4 years in complete misery. I am a Scorpio woman.
I would like to give really? Adrienne props for the confession, for the pronouns, and for saying her location, because there's a lot of information given in this confession. That is hilarious.
Yeah, I need to call my mom and find out what's up.
I love it. You know what? Get it where you can, Adrienne. You're being safe. You're social distancing. You're enjoying a man's voice in your ear. Why the fuck not? I mean, I don't know what that's like, but enjoy it. Enjoy it. This one is from Laura, pronoun she and her. Hello, ladies. Obviously, because of Corona, I have not been able to see my 94-year-old grandmother since March. She's a super interesting lady, and I've always tried to spend time with her, and being reduced to phone calls is sad, but I'm happy to have it. She and I are on the same page when it comes to politics, which I think she appreciates since my dad is on the more conservative side of the spectrum. She is appalled by the Trump, and I like to remember that she's been through 14 presidents. God, that's interesting.
Holy shit.
I want to share something she told me the other week. When she was a kid, she used to get into fist fights with other kids at school over President FDR. She was age 6 to 18 during his long presidency, and I love to think about her being a feisty little liberal 8-year-old grown up in San Francisco, slugging some other kid for wearing short trousers for bashing the New Deal. That's all. Nothing miraculous other than that. Come on. Nothing. That's amazing. Nothing miraculous other than I get to share what a cool grandma I have. Yes, you do. Oh, and to share cool pod pets. The cow is Priscilla and the sheep is Oliver. That's all. Thanks for all you do. I finally became a patron a few months ago, but still listen to the ad version since it's usually just long enough to be my audio accompaniment to both my morning dog walk and dog jog. All of these, this is so
look at
funny.
These.
Okay, so if you look at one of the pictures, one looks like a cow, yes. The other one looks like a sheep, and they're both beautiful dogs.
Yeah. So that's what she means by cow and sheep. The sheep is and the cow is. And I was like, wait, is there a sheep and a cow? Oliver and Priscilla. The cow is Priscilla.
Oliver's a beautiful pit. Is Oliver the pit? No, Priscilla's the pit.
No, Priscilla's the pit. I know. Look at the face. They're so adorable.
They got a bad rap. I love them so much. All right.
They do. It's a shame. Finally, we have one more here. I love how we sit here on a radio / podcast audio program and gush over photos so often. No one else, I think, would be able to get away with that.
That's true.
Thank you. Next up from Kimberly, pronouns she and her. Good news. Kimberly says, my husband's best friend recently became a U.S. citizen, and one of his adult daughters, 19, was sworn in during the pandemic as a citizen as well. The other is still in process. Little backstory, they are chosen family. She and her sister refer to me as Tia, and she often comes to me for major life decisions as an additional perspective to Dad. Dad is a single dad who had raised her and her sister alone since they were 3 and 6. He's an amazing dad, and my nieces are strong, self-sufficient, progressive women. Monday night, my niece texted me to see if I had time to talk. Of course I did. She called and we spent the next 20 minutes talking with her dad listening on how to vote, what they needed, who they should vote for, what happens when they refuse to vote for the Republican, even when that's the only candidate because they live in a very red county in northern Atlanta suburbs. And at the end of the call, they had their plan and they were ready to vote the following afternoon. I got texts of their line, 1.5 hours they waited, how prepared they were to vote, chairs, umbrellas, water, and finally, the I'm a Georgia voter sticker picture. Two new citizens voting blue in swing state Georgia. I cried. It was beautiful. There is hope.
I love it.
The fact that you can say swing state Georgia, right? Is wonderful. I hope they voted for, I don't know if you're in Devin Pandy's district there or what's happening. I think he said North Atlanta, rural suburb, but there's so many great candidates running in Georgia right now. There just are. And it's so wonderful.
I just think it's amazing that there is a very good chance we're about to flip 2 Senate seats there. At least there's a chance. I mean, not even to say this is Georgia. Who would have thought that we'd even be calling Georgia a swing state until now?
Mm, yeah, or Iowa or North Carolina.
Texas.
Yeah, what the F? Arizona isn't even it's likely Democrat now. And that was like, what? I grew up there. That is a red AF place.
8-point swing right now in Arizona. Trump won by 4 and he's losing by 4 to Biden right now.
Oh, wow. Well, everybody, check us out on our live election show results extravaganza. There will be booze regardless of the outcome. You'll get to see the McBabes. It's going to be so much fun. I hope you take a minute to stop by, and we'll be live streaming that. I'll send out more information as we have it. Anyway, that's it. Do you have any final thoughts, Dana, before we get out of here?
No, I mean, we are almost to the weekend. So just keep keep on keeping on. We've got single digits. We are less than one Scaramucci from the last day of voting. I'm not going to say the election anymore because it's happening. November 3rd is the last day to vote. Do not miss your opportunity, please.
Yes, and walk it in, hand it in. It's no good to do by mail anymore. You got to go and give it to somebody or put it in one of those official drop boxes. If you're in California, make sure it's not one of those Republican drop boxes.
Yeah, there should be a list if you flip over your ballot, at least there was in my district, of telling you exactly where the official drop boxes are, so it's on the back of your ballot. Make sure that's what you're following instead of whatever the GOP has put up around your area.
Yep, and you can go to iwillvote.com. You can find out there, too.
Perfect.
Right, well, thanks, everybody. Wonderful. Until tomorrow, everyone, please take care of yourselves, take care of each other, take care of the planet, and take care of your mental health. I've been AG.
And I've been DG.
Them's the beans. The Daily Beans is executive produced and directed by AG and Jordan Coburn, and engineered and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell and Starburns Industries. Our marketing manager, executive assistant, production and social media direction is Amanda Reeder. Fact-checking and research by AG, Jordan Coburn, and Amanda Reeder. Our music is written and performed by They Might Be Giants. Our web design and branding are by Joelle Reeder with Moxie Design Studios, and our website is dailybeanspod.com.
Hi, I'm Harry Littman, host of Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent figures from government law and journalism for a dynamic discussion of the most important topics of the day. Each Monday, I'm joined by a slate of Feds favorites and new voices to break down the headlines and give the insider's view of what's going on in Washington and beyond, plus sidebars explaining important legal concepts read by your favorite celebrities. Find Talking Feds wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary.
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me, in a courtroom, how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing in the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.